This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. What we like to eat, what we wear, the types of things we enjoy doing, we often put this down to plain old preference. But does this also extend to our choice of sexual partner? On social dating apps, it isn't uncommon to see racial preferences listed, whether explicitly or otherwise. Now, is this just preference in one of the most personal, intimate area of our lives, or could it be something else? Could it, in fact, just be racism? Answering that question today is Denton Callender, Research Fellow at the Kirby Institute at the University of New South Wales, who has conducted research in this area with interesting results. Denton, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So firstly, what interested you in this particular area of work or research?
Well, maybe 7 years ago now, I moved from Canada, where I grew up, to Australia, where I live now. And I was really struck by the different way that people in Australia spoke about race compared to the way that they were spoken about in Canada. And I was particularly interested in the way that it was talked about in the context of sex or romance. So I began investigating a bit deeper. I conducted a few research projects in this area. Since then, I've learned that every country speaks about race a little bit differently, but the common thread is that every country talks about race and that race is actually quite a salient aspect of people's lives, including when it comes to thinking about potential partners.
So sexual racism as a phrase is a relatively new one, I guess, in terms of it being common parlance in some senses. What falls within the definition of sexual racism?
Well, actually, the expression sexual racism was coined back in the 1960s in the United States when sociologists there were trying to get some sense of interracial marriage, mainly between black people and white people. So it's an idea that's actually been around for a while, but as you say, it's really only entered into our popular awareness or social awareness in the past decade, I would guess. And so when I talk about sexual racism, there are the individual things like making decisions about potential partners because of their race. But there's also the systemic things, the bigger picture stuff that tends to value or devalue certain racial groups as attractive or unattractive. And in doing so, you know, perpetuating these bigger systems of inequality that we see play out when it comes to race in many areas of our lives.
Is sexual racism kind of one of the last bastions of quote-unquote acceptable racism? Because if you say something sort of, you know, if you were to exclude somebody based on their race in many other settings, you know, you'd kind of be immediately pounced upon. But when it comes to who you choose to spend time with in that particular way, people don't seem to bat an eye.
It is true that people seem to be far more accepting of sexual racism than other forms of racism. And I think that's at least partly because, A, there are these arguments that people buy into that it's not actually an expression of racism. But also, you know, people are fairly protective of their own desires. I mean, I know I am in some respects. It sort of makes sense that these are my desires and how I express them is really my choice. But that type of mindset fails to recognize that, in fact, our desires aren't really our own, right? They don't just spring out of thin air. They're crafted over years of social experiences, and because of that, they're really better understood as, you know, reflections of society as opposed to something that we choose or something that we enact ourselves. So I think, you know, that's really my counter to that argument, but it's that argument that facilitates this type of normalization. And some of the research that I've done talking to people about this stuff or surveying them, it was really clear to me that for a lot of people, this is just part of their lives and they don't really question it. But when they're confronted with this idea that it's in fact harmful or that it's really just a reproduction of racism generally, I find that often gives people pause and, you know, it invites a somewhat deeper reflection. Now, in saying all that, well, we've seen a really drastic change in what is or isn't okay in terms of racism over the past, 50 or 100 years. We're also living in really unique times as the, recent outcome of the American election demonstrates to us. There's a real pushback against this perceived political correctness. And so, there's a lot of tension between those ideas. And what's really clear is people don't want to feel like they're being told they can't do something. But how you balance that against, the rights of other people to be treated fairly and equally, equitably, I should say, those are some really complex questions.
So how do practices surrounding dating and sex become racialized? I mean, is it racialized in the same way as every part of our lives? Or, is it a slow process? Because, of course, we're not born sexualized in that sense.
No, you're absolutely right. And some people might argue that we are, but there's no evidence to suggest that. Because when you look at, say, you're in Malaysia and you ask people, what's the most attractive racial group? The answer that they give you is completely different than you would get in Sydney, where I am, or, Johannesburg in South Africa. I mean, the fact that it's so contextual is, for me, really clear evidence that this is something that's socialized. So how that happens, well, it's probably a range of factors, not the least of which are the social cues that we get from our friends and our family, but also I think it's important to recognize the role that media plays in establishing what we might call a standard of beauty. So a lot of that, particularly in Australia, where the context with which I'm most familiar, the standard of beauty is one rooted in whiteness. So if you were to pick up a fashion magazine, 9 times out of 10, probably more than that, 99 times out of 100, you're going to see a white face looking back at you. So that signals to people implicitly that, this is what's attractive. But you also see that same type of representation in pornography. And that's where it starts to become directly relevant to our relationships or what people find attractive. Because, if you're watching these highly eroticized videos, but all you're seeing is our white bodies, that signals to you, whether or not you realize it, that this is what's attractive. And that has a direct impact on how your desires form over time.
In conversations that I've had just around the office and in my own personal life since I was talking about conducting this interview, there is a lot of pushback to the idea that, well, why can't I just say what I prefer? It's just what I prefer. And for example, in the Daily Beast article about your piece of research, they cited a gay blogger who said, "Don't tell me I can't have a preference. I don't want to have sex with women. No hard feelings. Does that make me a misogynist?" Why is it important for people to recognize maybe that preference may be something perhaps more insidious or something more?
Well, I think you've really hit on the greatest challenge that we face. So it's one thing for me as a social scientist to point to this and say, I think this is racism, I think it's an issue. But what I definitely know is that people do not like being called racist, and they tend to react pretty negatively to that. And so what I often try to do when, and I obviously have similar conversations with people when they find out the type of work that I do, what I try to do is reassure people that I'm not trying to call them specifically a racist, but I'm trying to help people see how we all, and we all do it in different ways, we are in some ways, slaves to these, to the historical racism that defines so many of our countries. So Canada, where I grew up, for example, is what we call a colonial nation. It's colonized by Europe, and it has echoes of that colonization that continue today. Same thing is true for Australia, and you could find similar examples in pretty much every country, often very painful, bloody, racist pasts. And so in some respects, it's astounding how far we've come in terms of, challenging and undermining that racism. But it's also pretty unsurprising that it would linger in so many of the ways that we see it lingering. So, I try to encourage people to see that bigger picture, that long picture that considers really what is actually quite a recent part of human history, and then invite them to see themselves as part of that, you know, that hangover, if you will, that hangover of racism. But what I find to be the most compelling piece of evidence is when I share with people some of the survey research that's been done around the world, including some of mine, which finds these really patterned racial attraction is actually really patterned. So, for example, we surveyed, I don't know, something like 2,000 men a few years ago, and we said, you know, who do you think is the most attractive? So we're not, you know, we're inviting people to evoke their stereotypes, their understandings of an imagined other person. And consistently, they ranked white people as the most attractive, and they ranked those they perceived as Asian, of Indian background, or Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander, Australia's indigenous people, as the least attractive. And in terms of the broader picture of racial, you know, what we might call the racial hierarchy or racial inequality, I mean, Asian, Indian, and Aboriginal people are historically and today the most marginalized racial groups in Australia. And if it were a matter of preference, as many people like to argue, then you would expect a degree of randomization. I mean, some people would like Asian people, some people wouldn't, some would like, you know, Middle Eastern men, so on and so forth, but it just doesn't work out that way. So in the social sciences, when you see those patterns, and these weren't just slight patterns, they were very pronounced, you have to assume that there's something going on that is deeper than an individual's preference.
Does that mean that every time we say, well, it's just a preference, we perhaps need to question that a bit more vigorously? Because I think for people in their daily lives, that can be something that, to put it simply, we're just too lazy to do.
For sure. And you know what? Most of us don't spend our days really critically analyzing our behaviors or our thoughts. We maybe should a bit more, but it's a complicated business, and it can be very tricky to drill down to the root cause of a thought, feeling, or behavior. But I would encourage everyone to do that, and that's partly why I'm really pleased that shows like yours and other shows around the world are inviting this bigger conversation with people. And as I said earlier, I'm not really interested in calling other people or labeling their desires as racist. But I do want to encourage people to, you know, have these discussions with themselves and ask, you know, why do I feel this way? And importantly, is what I'm saying or doing about those feelings, is it possibly hurting other people or impacting upon other people?
So just to kind of put the preference, the idea of preferences to bed, what is the difference between genuinely just having preferences and when does it slip over perhaps into this sort of societal socialized racism? Or is it always going to be one and the same?
That's a great question. And I think it's a very tricky one to answer. And it's one actually I get asked quite a bit. Because, of course, we are all going to maintain preferences. That's without a doubt true. You know, I, for example, think that I was going to try to come up with a preference of my own. That's probably walking into a minefield. But ultimately, what it comes down to is, are you making decisions about people based on a stereotype? Because stereotypes can be really useful mental tools for organizing a lot of information. But when it comes to assessing another human being, more often than not, they are inaccurate. And I certainly know I don't like someone making an assumption about me just based on one piece of information. And so I would encourage other people, you know, that's really where it becomes what we might call an act of racism or a racist thought. When you see someone across the room, you think, oh, that person's Indian. No, wouldn't be interested in them. You don't know a thing about them. You are getting a glimpse of their appearance from across the room. You're making a snap decision. That's, you know, pretty much case definition racism. And so that to me is sort of the fine line between just maybe having a preference. Maybe there's something you love about Indian culture or something you find a bit, something you don't quite understand about it. That's a bit different than making a stereotype-based judgment, if that makes sense.
It does. I'm speaking today with Denton Callender, Research Fellow at the Kirby Institute at the University of New South Wales. We're talking about sexual racism. Up next, we try to identify why certain populations seem to be more at risk of this, as well as hone in on how the survey research was conducted. You are listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. My guest today over the phone is Denton Callender, Research Fellow at the Kirby Institute in the University of New South Wales. We're talking today about sexual racism. So we've kind of established what it is. And you mentioned just now that at least in Australia, for example, certain populations appear to suffer the brunt of these attitudes. For example, Asian men or Asian people. And that's something that's reflected, especially the Asian man trope in the United States as well. What might be behind this sort of, what might be behind certain populations suffering more than others?
Well, in pretty much any country around the world, you're going to have one racial or ethnic group that is what we might call the dominant group. This is a group that maintains most control over social institutions, financial institutions, governments, and so on and so forth. And they tend to dictate the agenda, as it were. Whereas then you have other racial groups obviously fit somewhere within the society. And variously, they will be more or less discriminated against depending on their characteristics. So in sexual racism, what we find, and this is true no matter where you are in the world, that groups that appear to adhere to norms around masculinity or femininity tend to be more valued, whereas those that challenge it from a stereotypical standpoint tend to be less valued. So those that we think of as Asian, and I would say up front, that's actually such a problematic label. People often use it to describe the things that they do or do not want in a potential partner, but I mean, Asian is a huge, as you know, Asia is a huge continent, and the people there are so diverse, like, it almost is meaningless to call someone Asian in some respects because it could mean so many things. And yet it's a really, as you identified, it's a really common trope in America and Australia. But the reason that Asian men in particular seem to be singled out is because they become associated, the Asian identity becomes associated with femininity. So because Asian men are seen as somehow more feminine or more submissive, they become devalued in these racial hierarchies of attraction or unattraction. Whereas by contrast, women who are racialized as Asian, that can become a fetishized identity because they, adhere, and this is, of course, all on the basis of stereotypes, but they're seen as adhering to femininity, these ideals of femininity, whatever they might be. And, the same can be said of pretty much any other group. Black men and women, for example, in the United States, black men are seen as hypermasculine. Black women are also seen as hypermasculine, but those traits work for black men while working against black women. Mm. So, I mean, it's a whole complex range of issues that are sometimes quite ludicrous, but it's interesting how dominant they are across the world.
And of course, you've conducted research in this area. How did you conduct the survey that was cited?
So we did a survey in, I believe it was 2011, where we recruited a sample of gay men online to take part in a short survey. And I think we recruited about 2,100 participants. And we asked them a range of questions, including their specific practices associated with sexual racism, their experiences of sexual racism, also some questions about their racist attitudes more generally. And this was really, I think, one of the first surveys to try to do this with such a large sample. But as is often the case with these really complex social issues, there's only so much you can get out with a survey. So we also conducted a series of interviews, and we analyzed online dating profiles for the language that they used around sex and race.
Could you take us through the results? I mean, were you surprised by them?
That's a good question. In hindsight, maybe I shouldn't have been surprised by them, but I was. The survey, as I said earlier, I was really surprised by just how normalized this was, how accepting of it people were. And, you know, this research took place a few years ago now. And even in that short space of time, I really have noticed the conversation has shifted. People are talking about this a lot more. They're a lot more aware of it. They're asking questions. And it's moved out of being mainly a conversation among gay men, I would say, to being a conversation about relationships of all types. So that's really promising to me. But as we also talked about earlier, there's a surprising amount of reluctance of people to A, identify this as racism, and B, challenge it in themselves and other people. Most people are just happy for things to carry on as they are. And in some respects, I think that's alluring. You know, it would be much easier if we could say that's not really a problem. But one thing we did find that I was not really surprised by, but I was troubled by during the interview process of that research, was that this has an impact on people's lives. People feel ashamed of their race. They feel sad that they're excluded in some respects from these, you know, from the what we might call the sexual or romantic marketplace. And in some cases, they start to internalize this idea that their racial group is unattractive. And all of these things are, you know, the effects of prejudice, and they can have real impacts on people's mental health.
What are the factors that fed into people being more comfortable with sexual racism, whether it was on the side of the person saying, well, no Asians, and on the side of you know, the Asian person reading that and thinking, well, okay, I'll just move on to the next profile?
Well, we found a few different things. The first being, if you were more likely to score high on our scale of general racism, so you generally are pretty racist person, you might say. You were also more likely to think it was all right to discriminate among potential partners on the basis of their race. So in some ways, this is a kind of, I think, pretty unsurprising, right? But it draws, for the first time, a connection between those two things. And it challenges, again, this argument that racial preferences among partners is just a matter of preference. But we also found a few other things, like younger people were more likely to think it was acceptable to discriminate among potential partners. People who spent more time online looking for partners were more likely to think it was okay. So some interesting interactions here that, you know, invite some critical reflection about how online spaces, you know, the online search for partners may actually reinforce this idea that it's okay and that it's natural to discriminate among potential partners on the basis of their race.
Well, I mean, does the fact that these interactions are mediated perhaps make it less fraught?
Well, yes and no. I think one thing, you know, from speaking with people about this, one thing that I found, most people were like, fine, whatever, that happens. And when I'm annoyed with someone, I can just disconnect. And that's actually quite a useful strategy, particularly if you're experiencing harassment of any kind. You can just cut and run at any point. But on the flip side, it also creates an opportunity for people to do that as a way to exclude those that they think don't meet certain criteria. So it becomes a bit tricky because people grow suspicious that they're being excluded because of their race, even if they can't pinpoint that as the case. And because we see other sources of data, there was actually a great study from the United States a few years ago that looked at message responses and found really patterned on, I think the website was eHarmony or something like that, and found that, for example, black women were the messages they sent were the least likely to be responded to, whereas white men, the messages they sent were the most likely to be responded to, and stuff like that. So these subtle cues that we can capture through online data that are happening offline as well, but because they're happening in the interweb, you know, and we can archive that information, we can have access to that information, you know, for social scientists, that makes that type of analysis possible. But oh, sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say that in some ways, the idea behind these apps might also make it seem like you're just making a choice from a virtual marketplace. And does that kind of notion of being able to shop around make it easier to perhaps, say, more explicitly sort your partners by categories, including race?
Definitely. I think you've really hit the nail on the head there. And it's one of the the challenges of these types of online services is that they signal to people that the best way to find a potential partner is to list all the things that you want and don't want. And for me, that's really problematic because, you know, it homogenizes your dating pool. It makes pretty much everyone the same. And it assumes that you know what you want or need in a potential partner. And, you know, I don't know about you, but my experience has been that often the most rewarding relationships I have are those that I at least expected. And it's that diversity of partner that I think really makes sex and dating way more exciting. So, you know, these apps, the fact that they even have categories of race, in some ways that implicitly reinforces that race is a natural category for partner discrimination. It raises a whole bunch of really interesting and complex issues. And, you know, in some respects, it makes me a little bit, I don't want to say sad, but it makes me feel like people are maybe missing out on the types of connections that could be possible because they're excluding so many people on the basis of race, but on the basis of a whole other a host of criteria as well.
With that said, can sexual racism leak out into other parts of one's life as well? Or, you know, earlier you were talking about how people with more sort of generally racist attitudes perhaps were also more comfortable with sexual racism. But can the reverse also be true? Could somebody be, you know, the most sort of open-minded person otherwise, but when it comes to this, they sort of fiercely protect that and then it ends up leaching out, I guess?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I should be clear, the nature of that, the analysis that I described earlier, it doesn't actually allow us to say that one thing causes the other. But the reality is probably a bit of both, right? The expressions of sexual racism are in many senses reflections of racist attitudes more broadly. But also, you know, if you maintain this idea that people are different because of their race, it seems only natural to me that that would filter into your thinking, and it would, you know, you wouldn't maybe necessarily be able to see it, and you might not even recognize it in yourself. But it's as you say, it could very easily leak out into other parts of your life, and I think it would probably be impossible to contain those two things.
Does this kind of come down in some ways also to a matter of language and semantics? For example, you know, people might be more open to describing something as racial exclusion or preference as opposed to just saying, well, yeah, okay, fine, you know, it's maybe a little racist.
Yeah, I think that it's also important to recognize, you know, this label of racism, maybe, I know there's this perception, you see it in public discussions online, on Twitter, you know, there's this perception that we, quote-unquote, we in the social sciences are a bit obsessed with labeling things as racist. And maybe it is semantics in some respects, but that's such a powerful and important label that carries with it such weight, you know, it really signals that this is a challenging and troubling issue, that I think when we see it, we need to identify it as such. And we need to help people see it as such so that they can understand the gravity of their decisions, the gravity of their, you know, their thinking processes, and hopefully not as a way to shame them, but as a way to hopefully encourage change, encourage reflection, if that's possible. Maybe I'm overly optimistic, but I do think that's possible.
And outside of academic interest, why is it so important to pinpoint sexual racism? I mean, what are the outcomes of having it practiced on a sort of more casual scale?
Well, as I alluded to earlier, we see some direct effects of experiencing it on people, things like shame, guilt, internalization of racism. But also, you know, anything that divides us as a society, we must be suspicious of and we must challenge wherever we can. And the racism that exists today, for the most part, the American election notwithstanding, is exactly like sexual racism in that it's difficult to see, it's very subtle, and it's sort of, I think, from my optimistic viewpoint, it's the last gasp of racial inequality in some respects. And so if we can continue to challenge it whenever we see it, you know, hopefully in 100 years or 200 years, our children won't be asking these same questions. They'll be, you know, we'll have moved on from that. Now, maybe that's never possible. Maybe I'm completely deluded. But we won't know until we continue to confront these issues and say, okay, any form of inequality is not okay.
Have the findings of the study and your work in this area shaped your views on sexual racism and preference and desire in particular? Because I remember you kind of mentioning earlier on that, of course, people are protective of their desires. Has it changed the way you view yourself and, you know, how you conduct yourself in these spaces?
Yeah, you know, it definitely has. At the very least, it's given me an awareness for just the wide diversity of interests that people have when it comes to sex or romance. But also, it's given me an appreciation that really, I think we all kind of want the same thing, right? We want rewarding experiences connecting with other people. So recognizing that everyone basically wants that same thing has helped me, you know, be a little bit more sensitive to the way that people behave in online spaces, but also, you know, thinking about myself, trying to be a little bit more open, being a bit more willing to do different types of things, things that I might not necessarily think are things that I think of, you know, top of my list of things that I want. Now, I'm not saying that people should just go out and sleep with every person who comes in their path. But, you know, like, be willing to be challenged, be willing to, you know, take chances. That's really what it's all about. And for the most part, you know, I have to say that works pretty well for me. So I would encourage anyone who's listening to do the same, like, just do something different. And I think you'll be delighted with the results.
So in closing then, for somebody who feels like they might be on the receiving end of sexual racism, who've grown tired of seeing the, you know, no Asians or in the local setting, I guess, no Chinese girls, no Indian girls, no Malay men, for example, how would you suggest they engage with it and the person on the other side of that statement?
Well, that's a tricky question too. And, you know, I've talked to people a lot about this, and sometimes they find it cathartic to snap back, to call people out. But often that leads nowhere, I've got to say. Often the response will just be to block the person if it's an online setting, or, you know, basically just to write it off as some crazy person. The first thing I would encourage people to do, if, you know, if they're feeling the effects of this, is to talk to someone, talk to a friend that they trust, or, you know, to someone they trust about their experiences. Try not to let it overwhelm them. But also pragmatically, to just focus your efforts elsewhere. Get out of online spaces if you can, and try not to let, it's a bit trite, and I don't want to encourage people to ignore these issues, but to best direct their energy. I really don't think that, for the most part, confronting people online about this works really well. I just don't see that as a really valuable strategy. But trying to challenge your friends about it as well, you know, if you're having a conversation with someone and they bring it up, you know, ask them, you know, where does this come from? Why do you feel this way? I'm not sure that's the most helpful advice, but it's the most practical advice I can offer.
Thank you very much, Denton. I've been speaking today with Denton Callender, Research Fellow at the Kirby Institute at the University of New South Wales, and we've been discussing sexual racism. You've been listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.